don't get to sleep in the nighttime. They spend the daytime wide awake. Some folks, they got to work at night, get to sleep right through the day. Some guys don't work at all, they get to dream their lives away. How's that sleeping? Close your eyes and go down. Drink, sleep, sleeping. Don't you know life, she just died. Sweet, sweet dreams. They put your words on the bed. Go back to sleeping, sleepy head. Now some people get to sleep in king-size beds, silk sheets and Loctite doors. Some may sleep 5 to a room with old mattresses on the floor. But when the police say, hey, you can't sleep there, you don't get to sleep no more. I said sleeping, close your eyes and go down. She just died. Sweet, sweet dream. They put your words on the bed. Back to sleeping, sleepy head. You know, when too much be going on, I get no sleep sometimes. It's like I'm losing control. I'm losing sleep, that's why. Say if you wound too tight, you got to make yourself unwind. I said sleeping, close your eyes and go down. Stream, sleep, sleeping. Don't you know life is just a sweet, sweet dream. Say put your words on the bed, go back to sleeping, sleepy head. You know there's nothing wrong with it. I said sleeping is no crime. Even God rested on the Sabbath, healed the body, soul, and mind. Yes, it does. Don't let nobody tell you how. Don't let nobody tell you where. You just got to sleep when that sleep's that thin. That's right, sleeping. Close your eyes and float down.
That, of course, was Mike True, Sleepin'. You are tuned to Free Radio at 96.3 FM, Free Radio Santa Cruz, that is. On the line here with me, or I should say in the studio, he's actually present physically, is our first guest of the day, perhaps our last guest of the day, we'll see, Paul Mercelin Sampson, who has been, shall we say, checking out the local Metro scene. He's the Metro Writers Union man. Hey there, how you doing, Paul?
Fine, thanks.
And I know that we heard you were going to explode upon the Friday Metro Riders Transit District. Actually, it's the Transit Union. Give me, what's the name of our official organization there, their organization?
The SCMTD, not the best acronym. It's Santa Cruz Metropolitan Transit District.
Metropolitan Transit District.
Better than Santa Cruz Municipal Utilities, which I like to call SCUM instead of SCMU.
Well, that has a kind of a more familiar ring. You went, I guess, a week ago Friday, or maybe it was even 2 weeks ago Friday, you announced you were going to be attempting to speak at the oral communications segment, and that there have been apparently some written dissent raised as to whether you should even be allowed to raise the topics you wanted to raise. You want to kind of review that for us?
Yes, I had announced my intention to present some cartoons that appeared and were up until very recently on the website of UTU Local 23. That's the bus drivers labor organization. And these cartoons were targeted at bus riders. For example, there was one, Half Stroller Will Travel Anywhere Except Planned Parenthood. Other derogatory kinds of comments like those. And I had announced my intention to show those to the board of directors. And the UTU Local 23 chair wrote a letter to the board saying that I should not be allowed to speak at the board meeting, and that these cartoons were not a transit district topic, even though, of course, they focus on transit district riders and were produced by a transit district employee group.
And who signed this letter asking that you be mercifully silenced so the community could be spared your twaddle?
Bonnie Moore, UTU Local 23 chair.
Bonnie Moore. Bonnie's actually an old pal of mine. I'm going to have to get on her case and find out what's going on. So anyway, then you arrive with trepidation and perhaps a bullhorn, ready to be dragged off if necessary to make your, after you made your comments. What happened when you arrived on Friday?
Well, I was allowed to speak. There was no issue with that from Metro's perspective or from even the board members' perspective. And I showed one of the cartoons. Of course, we're limited to 3 minutes. I got five as it was, but I really only had time to show one of the six or seven cartoons.
Which cartoon did you show?
I showed the Half Stroller Will Travel. That one gets me the worst, and I've been showing these to members of the community in general, and that's the one that strikes a chord with everyone. And so that's the one I showed. And afterwards, the labor groups are given an unlimited amount of time in the agenda to speak. And so Ms. Moore got up and she recruited folks from SEIU Local 415, the sister union, to get up and speak as well. It was quite amusing. But Ms. Moore denied that the cartoons had been on the website in October when I retrieved them from the website. The printout that I have has a date stamp, and it also has a list of the dates of the cartoons. And so she really contradicted reality. And she said I was a computer whiz and that somehow I had
gotten
the cartoons.
A fraud, eh?
Yes. So it was fascinating. And then she didn't address the whole censorship question. I've never been in favor of censoring the cartoons. I don't think that hate literature is protected or needs to be protected. I mean, certainly threatening literature isn't protected, but I'm all for publishing it. I would publish it on any of my personal websites or the Writers Union website to show people what the drivers think of us as writers. But Bonnie Moore and the UTU Local 23 took it upon themselves to remove the cartoons from their website. So they didn't address the self-censorship that's going on here.
Huh. And they apparently, if you're accurate in what you said, and I have not investigated this personally myself, so I can't say, but Moore was, you think Moore was misinformed, or do you think she was consciously, should we say, lying?
I really can't say. I don't want to make conjectures. I do know from speaking with other people at the district that she came up with a number of conspiracy theories over the course of the week, leading up to the meeting, and that various people were accused at different stages of having given me the cartoons, people that I have had really no interactions with.
So a witch hunt has ensued. You're reproducing a complete clean out of the, what's Bonnie Moore's union?
UTU Local 23.
So what's the website of this issue, of this website, what's the address of this website in case people want to go there and, find out what's cooking and maybe even register some historical questions?
You can go to www.local23.org. The cartoons are gone. There is now, as of Thursday before the meeting, in other words, the day before the meeting, there's a big banner that comes up when you click on the cartoon link, which is still there, and it says this section of the site is for the enjoyment of UTU employees only. So that's all that people will see today.
And do you have to give your private UTU passcode to get in there?
No, there's actually nothing behind it. There's no mechanism for accessing the content.
Well, how can the UTU members enjoy nothing? Doesn't that seem a little bit contrary to the holiday spirit?
I know for a fact that page was added the night, either 1 or 2 days before the meeting, because I have a printout of the site from the day prior.
And how long did this entire discussion at the week ago Friday's transit board meeting take?
It went on quite a while, I'd say, with board member comments about a half hour. Unfortunately, what this is meant to show is that, you know, we need to create... we need to foster good relations between the riders and the district, the administration of the district, and also the employees of the district. And that point was lost because there was so much focus on, were the cartoons up or were they not? You know, denying reality. You know, we have the piece of paper in front of us, and we don't want to confront the content. We want to dance around it.
Huh. You know what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask my producer, who may be listening in, to give Bonnie Moore a call and see if we can get old Bonnie to call in. I like Bonnie, you know, and I'm just wondering why she took the stance she did, and maybe we can get some thoughts from her about, you know, what kind of forgery is happening here with you and your vicious attacks on the poor transit union. Let me get some of these organizational names right one more time. We're talking about the board meeting, and again, the name of the board is the...
Santa Cruz Metropolitan Transit District. That's the SCMTD, or Santa Cruz Metro.
And the union in question that Bonnie heads is...
Is the UTU Local 23. That's United Transportation Union, Local 23.
And that covers...
They represent, at Metro, the drivers. They also represent Amtrak, operating staff, and operators for Los Angeles and for a number of other transportation companies around the country.
Mm-hmm. So, have you had any threatening letters, rocks thrown through your window, deportation demands, things of that sort?
Thankfully not, but I did have to read the riot act on that. I was slandered in the Sentinel by Ms. Moore. Again, she claimed that I didn't have a job, and she wrote a letter saying, when you have a job, you'll appreciate the protections that unions afford, and she made me out to be, you know, unknowledgeable about labor history and opposed to labor, even though I participate in strikes and have volunteered here in this county with a labor union that has real gripes against its employer.
And which union is that?
That's the Coalition of University Employees, Q. That's the clerical workers at UCSC.
Uh-huh.
The people who are not paid a living wage. They earn perhaps $10, $11 an hour in many cases. And they have a really bad situation, even compared to private industry. So that's a cause I can fight for.
And what Sentinel letter are you referring to?
I don't have the exact date. I can get that for you. But it was a letter to the editor that was published. I sent a note to the Sentinel. I said, you know, this is a case of slander, and I was given the opportunity to publish a rebuttal to the letter. And at that point, the dialogue stopped very quickly. I think Ms.
Did you
Moore
publish a rebuttal?
Yes, I did. Yeah, and I think Ms. Moore realized that she'd picked the wrong public relations campaign this time.
Uh huh. Well, she may be misinformed by, as they used to say, of the czar, evil advisors. So perhaps, well, who knows? Maybe we can get some kind of response from her in the minutes ahead. In fact, what I'm going to do is I'm going to throw on a little music and make a few mad phone calls in case anybody here wants to call in and give their thoughts on this, whether disgruntled bus drivers or bus riders or anybody else. The number here is 427-3772. You're listening to Paul Marcel and Sampson and, of course, the inimitable Robert Norse. That's me. On Free Radio Santa Cruz at 96.3 FM. Again, 427-3772 or rnorse2 at hotmail.com. I will attempt to check the Hotmail at least every few weeks. Actually, I'm going to check it every few minutes here and hopefully pick up any messages and questions you might have. 427-3772. In the meantime, let's hear a little more Mike True, and then we'll be back with this raging debate, or perhaps this resolved debate, since we haven't got only one of the parties here. Maybe we can actually... get a real exchange. Let's see. Stay with us. This is not Mike True. This is Surreal, by the way. Sorry about that.
The magic of your love descends upon me. Nothing in my world can ever be the same. No matter where I go, no matter what I do, my whole life is blazing with a brand new flame. You master all the mysteries of night. your all resounds for the sacred history. Who can decipher the maze of mysteries you've become? You're reserving yourself as the final mystery. You don't need to wave a magic wand or fly across the sky to prove your stuff. You don't have to serve me a special potion. The fire of your eyes and voice are proving up. That's how I know you're my sorcerer. A saucy sorcerer, casting all her spells. An audience enchanter, spinning all her wild. You're a sorcerer, believe me, I can tell. Sorcerer, show me your magic mirror. Sorceress, I love to climb your sacred tree. Sorceress, you got me in your magic web. Sorceress, will you ever set me free? Nothing in my world can ever be the same. No matter where I go, no matter what I do, my whole life is blazing with a brand new flame. You mastered all the mysteries of night. Pure resound with a secret history. Who can decipher the maze of riddles you become? You're reserving yourself as a final mystery. You don't need to wave a magic wand or fly across the sky to prove yourself. You don't have to serve me a magic potion. The fire of your eyes and voice are proof enough. But I know you're my sorcerer. A saucy sorcerer, casting all the spells. Saudi enchanters spinning all the while. You're a sorcerer, believe me, I can tell. Sorcerer, show me your magic mirror. Sorcerer, I love to climb your sacred tree. Sorcerer, you got me in your magic web. Oh, sorcerer, will you ever set me free?
That was Sir Real, also known as Inimitable Ernie, Man of the Streets. He's a real street musician person and has been hassled up at UCSC and elsewhere for playing the piano. Dig it. He seems to play the piano pretty well, and he was playing the piano the other night at the Vets Hall, the other day, I should say, when the Christmas meal was being served to 400 plus, or was it 800? I'm not quite sure what the numbers were at that Christmas meal, but they were, you know, people availed themselves of that turkey meal. I had even sat down and chowed down a bit myself. That happens, unfortunately, twice a year, Thanksgiving and Christmas. It's a chance for people to get together and chat. Anyway, while we were on the, I should say, while you were listening to that music out there from Surreal, who, by the way, does sell a CD. If you want to get copies of that and support a homeless person, because he's homeless, give a call to the Huff line, 423-HUFF. I'll put you in touch with him. Good music. And if, of course, he tries to sell it on the streets, he gets hassled by the police. While we were listening to Surreal, the producer contacted Bonnie Moore. And Bonnie may be listening in right now. Hi, Bonnie, if you're listening. I've got a lot of positive things to say about Bonnie and always have in the past in terms of her willingness to stand up to human rights abuses in Santa Cruz, like the sleeping ban, which actually I think everybody in his right mind should stand up to, but unfortunately, apparently, you turn in your mind when you join the city council. So, Paul, we've talked a little bit, and I know Bonnie just tuned in, so she hasn't heard most of this, and I'm not going to repeat it because there are a lot of other listeners listening, but the critique we've discussed so far has been about the discussion around exchanges about nasty cartoons on the UTU Local 23 website mocking folks who are writers. And you, Paul, are, of course, Metro Writers Union founder or co-founder, is that a fair way to call it? And you've got some more substantive issues you want to bring up, and we want to invite Bonnie to call in and discuss anything she wants, particularly those issues, since that she is indeed knowledgeable, I suppose, specifically knowledgeable on those particular issues, as well as a driver herself. So what issues do you think need to be examined as we come into the new year?
This right of respect issue that we were just talking about, and I think we've made an impression. The board members see it now. The public is becoming aware of this problem, and I think in general relations between writers and bus drivers, like the line bus drivers, are very good. I'll assume that issue is resolved or can be resolved, and that in future we won't see these attacks. But the major issue for 2004 is Metro's budget. And Metro will have a new budget year starting July 1st, 2004. And Metro has already promised some very, very high raises to the UTU. And in general, these raises are matched for the other. There are three categories of employees at Metro. You have your bus operators, the UTU Local 23 people. You have your management. There are only 13 managerial employees on a staff of 300. They're not represented. And then you have SEIU Local 415, who's everybody else. And I think SEIU's contract is up this year, but UTU has 1 year to go. And Metro has promised all senior UTU drivers, that's anyone with more than 5 years of experience, a raise totaling 9.4% next year. This following on the heels of raises every year that were higher than the cost of living, higher than the consumer price index. And we're also not talking about raises that people get when they're promoted, raises that people get when their job duties change, raises that people get when their experience increases. We're talking about the discretionary raise, and it should be the cost of living, and it is going to be 9.4% for those people. Everyone else, all the junior employees, will get a 4.2% raise, again more than the cost of living, which is between 2 and 2.5% at this time and has been for several years. And those people also, of course, get their step increases, you know, as they gain experience. And you know, I'm not taking issue with the step increases, but I am taking issue with continuing history of cost of living raises that are much more than cost of living.
So, well, it's pretty straightforward. If anybody out there wishes to comment on that, 427-3772 is the phone number to call in, 427-3772, 427-FRSC. If you're out of the area, 831 is the area code, 831-427-3772. And if you happen to be listening to us, well, you could be listening to us on many different stations, but I guess you're likely to be listening on 96.3 FM or 101.1 FM if you're in the sort of further south in the county. So I guess those issues will be coming up in July, I guess, or perhaps before July.
Yeah, in the springtime. And I should say a word about impact. We have had 2 years of service cuts in this district, and we had a major fare increase from 25 to 50%, depending on the category, last summer, before last summer's round of raises. And if this goes ahead, what the UTU is already programmed to receive, and then a 4.2% COLA for the other employees, assuming that they'll all get parity in that respect of the 4.2, then we'd be looking at either a fare increase larger than the one that we had last summer, so more than 25 to 50%, depending on the category, or double the service cut that we had last summer in the worst-case scenario. So those are some pretty steep impacts.
So what what percentage of the budget does salary make up? I mean, does the wages make up?
It's hard to pin down because it's all divided very finely, but the exact salary exposure is about $12 million for all three categories of employees. The UTU is just over $6 million of that. And then you have other things that track salaries, for example, retirement contributions, FICA, that's federal, you know, the payment of Social Security tax by the employer's share, things like that. So for the UTU folks, you go from $6 million in basic salaries to about $8 million when you factor in those things. And then you have your other non-UTU employees, and it just goes on from there. So it's a substantial portion. And then you also have benefits that are not related to salary. For example, all employees at the district receive automatically $600 a month or more toward their health care. And that's promised to them in their contracts. And it's not cash. It's the district's contribution to their health premiums, but it's a fixed amount monthly regardless of the amount of work that a person does, et cetera. So you add these things in, and you've got, you know, that's the single largest. Employee compensation is definitely the single largest item in the budget. I can do it. I can total them up for you next time.
Is it a majority of the budget that the?
Oh yeah, it's more than 50%.
And this budget mostly comes from local taxes or from federal and state grants. Local taxes.
Half the budget is local tax. That's the half-cent sales tax throughout the county on all purchases of goods except food and a few other exempt items, and so half a cent goes to Metro. That's half the budget, $15 million. Another quarter of the budget is also from a local sales tax, but it's indirect. It's from a statewide sales tax, but it's a local. It's the amount raised in this county, and it goes to the state, and it comes back to us. I think that's called state transit assistance. So 3/4 of the budget is sales tax, 20% is fares, and then the rest is small amounts of federal and state grants. We don't receive a lot.
And how does this compare? Let me ask you this. How do the salaries of drivers in our area compare with, let's say, drivers in San Francisco or Los Angeles, Santa Barbara, other coastal areas where it's fairly expensive to live?
The big determiner is public versus private system. So in the San Francisco Bay Area, you've got about 30 transit operators. The public folks earn about the same, and they're all, whether it's L.A., whether it's San Francisco, whether it's Golden Gate Transit in Marin County, wherever it is, they're all going to be very similar in California. They're all very successful in getting the top wages. Of course, they have the top cost of living. But then the private folks who provide service in certain areas of the Bay Area receive significantly less. I'm not sure that we should be paying the people less. I'm concerned about stopping outrageous growth in the salaries. That's my focus. I don't really think that we should be reducing people's salaries. I think we need to keep an eye on the growth in the salaries and keep that growth in line with the cost of living. That's all I'm saying.
Mm-hmm. Have you had any public debates on this issue with those with different views? I guess you have at the board meeting, the Santa Cruz Metro Transit District meeting, which you regularly attend.
If I could get people to come to a meeting to debate that issue, I'd love to have it. And, you know, perhaps some of your listeners would be interested in coming. You know, if we were assured of an active group of people to discuss it, you know, maybe even do it on air, I would love to have that debate, have folks call in or, mm-hmm. you know, rent a room at the library. I would love to do it. In general, until June 4th, which will be the eve of the service cuts, or June 30th, which would be the eve of the fare increase, is very hard to get folks to come out and talk about these things, because they're not real until you see your bus canceled or until you see your fare jump to $2. Then people start to worry. So it might happen later in the year.
So your concern is not the, you know, overpaid drivers or overpaid employees. It is more service cuts. That's your concern?
Because the pay increases cause service cuts in this climate where there's no other money coming in. Other revenues are flat. Anytime you raise pay and benefits, you wind up cutting service or raising fares. There's no other way. Those things are all held in balance.
Mm-hmm.
It's a zero-sum game until the economy starts growing again.
Now, this is all you're a passionate bus rider. You don't own a vehicle, or you do own a vehicle?
I do not, and have never owned a vehicle.
Mm-hmm. Are you a bicycle rider? Or?
Actually not. I ride a stationary bike at home. We're working on fixing a bike, but I don't ride one out around town. I walk, and I use the bus and the train and other things like that.
Now, did you have a similar? You're originally and recently from Canada, right?
No, from Toronto is where I grew up.
And did you have similar concerns about how Toronto treated its services in terms of bus services? Were they better up there? Or?
Much better. Transit in Toronto is the exact opposite of what it is in most American cities. Maybe New York would be comparable in the U.S., but in Toronto, about one-third of the population rides the bus every day, or rides the subway in that case. It's a combination of buses, subways, and streetcars in Toronto. So about one-third of the people use the system every day. Whereas we get 20% of our revenue here in Santa Cruz from fares, Toronto gets over 80% of its revenue from fares. So it's a much healthier system financially. You have buses that come every 2 hours. The subway has no schedule because it actually comes no less often than every 6 minutes. Buses that come very frequently. You've got the demand to support it. We don't have that here in California.
Now, what about San Francisco, which might be, I don't know, how many people live in Toronto?
Toronto is a city of about 2.5 million right now.
So San Francisco is about a little bit less than half that, but it does have similar transit systems, you know, subways, trolleys, buses. How do they stack up with Toronto as far as service and then the revenue, the percentage that... How much of the budget comes from fares?
San Francisco's population actually is only 700,000. It's actually a very small city, population-wise and geographically.
Well, it's part of the bigger Bay Area.
We'll talk about San Francisco first. Bay Area is a can of worms because there are 30 separate transit agencies. Mm-hmm. But San Francisco gets about 30% of its revenue from fares. Service levels in San Francisco are higher. They're definitely lower than what they are in Toronto, and the use of transit on a per capita basis is lower in San Francisco than it is in Toronto, New York, other big transit cities. San Francisco also is facing serious problems with its budget. They had a fare increase in September, and so it's the same story everywhere in California.
So and that's quite a difference, though. 30% of the budget compared with 80% of the budget. Is that because that there's a significantly larger number, greater percentage of people riding in Toronto, or because Toronto is a larger city, or are there other factors involved?
It's really the per capita share. You've got full buses, and you don't, even in San Francisco, except for perhaps three or four trunk services, you don't really have full buses. Here in Santa Cruz, we've got full buses on perhaps three or four corridors. That's the University corridor, the Santa Cruz, Cabrillo, Capitola Mall, Watsonville corridor, that general area, and the corridor between Santa Cruz and Scotts Valley. And those are the financially healthy parts of the system where you've got full buses. The rest of it, unfortunately, runs with, you know, buses that are much less than full, and it becomes even harder there to cover your costs.
So you weren't engaged in similar struggles to cap salaries of workers up in Toronto?
Well, in Toronto, there's a... how can I say this? We've had two transit strikes in my memory in Toronto, and there is, in general, a greater discipline there fiscally, and you haven't seen the kinds of outrageous raises. Those people have never gotten 10%, not since the 70s, since stagflation years, when you had to give those raises because that was the increase in the cost of living. Cost of living was going up 10% in 1 year, maybe 15%. You haven't seen that kind of excessive raise since, and it wasn't excessive in those days, but you haven't seen excessive raises.
And why is that?
Again, there's a greater discipline there. There's a sense of restraint. The agency has to be faithful to its riders because the riders are the ones paying. You can't turn them away. You can't piss them off. They're the ones who are paying. If you alienate them by raising fares and you lose their business, you lose your system, you lose your jobs. We don't have that discipline here because, you can raise fares, you will lose some riders, but you've still got your state sales tax, you've still got your local sales tax, you've still got three quarters of your budget intact.
So the issue, getting back to Santa Cruz, for Santa Cruz residents who want better service, is to you're seeing it primarily as an attempt to stop the unions from hiking up the salaries? I mean, is that your solution to the situation?
Or? That's one of them, hiking up salaries at the expense of service. Again, cost of living is fine. Promotions and reclassifications and gains in experience, those things are fine. But on the cost of living side, you've got to hold it to the consumer price index. It can't grow without limit. That's one solution.
Mm-hmm. And that seems to be your primary focus. I mean, you also, of course, are concerned about, well, in the past we've talked about you're being barred from distributing literature at the transit center. It looks like we may have a call coming in. Let's see who who's calling in on this. Hi, you're well, you were on Free Radio, and you can be on Free Radio again. 427-3772 is a number where you'd be on the air with Paul Marcel and Sampson and myself, Robert Norris. This is Free Radio, so feel free to give a call in, 427-3772. If for some reason you don't want to be on the air but you want to leave me a message, you can do it on the Huff line at 423-HUFF, 423-HUFF, 423-4833. That's Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, and also my phone. It's just a voicemail, but I'll be checking it after the show. And perhaps you want to arrange for some kind of future discussion on the air. You have a question, you can do it that way, 423-HUFF. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
I wanted to contradict your guests.
Oh, good.
Opinions regarding transportation in Santa Cruz County.
Alrighty.
We are not densely populated like San Francisco or Manhattan and Toronto. I'm not sure whether your guest has any experience commuting over the hill.
Have you, Paul, any experience commuting over the hill?
I do, and I actually have experience with longer commutes. I had a two-hour each-way commute when I was in San Francisco to my job in the Tri-Valley, Dublin, Pleasanton, Livermore area for a long time. So I know what commuting is like, and I'm a regular user of the Highway 17 Express.
Do you think it's applicable for most people that commute over the hill to take a bus?
Absolutely not. And this is, you know, this is, unfortunately, I'm in firefighting mode. You know, we're fighting to save the district financially. That's been a battle that's come up. The district's been on the verge of financial disaster several times in the last few years before I came here. So this is an immediate battle. But improving service, and you won't get folks to ride over the hill unless you provide a real express bus service, which means the bus picks people up in Santa Cruz or in Watsonville or in whatever location. There's one pickup, doesn't stop at 10 different places, and it goes directly over the hill, and it can do whatever it takes to get through the traffic, take shortcuts.
What if you're involved in sales?
Pardon?
Ride the bus to your various sales calls?
Pardon?
Let's say you're involved in sales. Let's say you have to go to maybe three or four different stops a day,
uh-huh.
somewhere in the Silicon Valley area. Just as an example. Now, what do? Do you ride the bus between stops?
Well, that would be my experience. I mean, I run a small business, and in the past, when I have been finding customers and going to purchase things and running the business, I wind up making those omnibus trips where you start out at 5:30 in the morning and you take your bus and you take another bus. I know that
really
doesn't work for most
people. That's the future.
I don't think so. I think that we need a better level of service
and
a better approach.
What do you think about intelligent highways?
Pardon?
Do you know about intelligent highways? What do you know about intelligent highways?
Are you talking about, for example, high occupancy toll lanes or personal rapid transit?
No. I'm talking about what's coming up on the near horizon is the ability to detect how near you are to other vehicles and whether you're crossing over the meridian.
Oh, okay.
These kinds of things are within the next couple of years. What's going to be on the radar screen in the far future will be the ability to have the car self-navigate with embedded features in the highway. If Santa Cruz wanted to take a lead in some of these intelligent highway opportunities, it could do so with Highway 1, but I don't see that happening because there is this ridiculous, absurd approach towards self-propelled vehicles. As if we're going to solve the transportation problems with a trolley between Santa Cruz and Aptos and Capitola.
Well, the trolley.
And I really think that most of the folks that make these arguments have really very little experience with real life work.
Well, have you heard me say anything about the trolley, quite honestly,
no.
In the newspapers or here on this radio station?
No. And buses, Santa Cruz is not densely populated. You're going to have a couple of decent arterial routes for buses, but by and large, this community, which is semi-rural, is going to have to figure out how to deal with cars.
I would agree with you to an extent, but one thing I'll tell you...
I really don't understand why cars are so berated. Well, and you know, a lot of the bikesters that I know, by the way, if I might just say 30 seconds more and then I'll shut up, a lot of the bikesters that I've met over the years are from very wealthy backgrounds.
It's not that way.
We're
trust
fund kids.
Don't
have to turn a buck.
Bob, we don't want you to shut up, but let's have Paul get a chance
That's
to respond.
Right. Go ahead, Paul.
All I wanted to say, I agree with you about the impracticality of using transit, and that's one of the things that we work on at the Writers Union. I was up in Sassoon, actually, fighting for better bus and train schedules on some service that touches Santa Cruz County, the Amtrak Capital Corridor bus that many of us use to get over the hill also when the Highway 17 isn't running, etc. So, you know, we worry about delivery of the service and ways of improving it, but as far as transit usage in this county, we are actually very unusual. We're one of eight jurisdictions in the country that is in what would be called the high intensity transit tier for small cities. We fit in under the federal government's guidelines in the under 200,000 area population-wise, even though of course our population is about 250,000. We fit into this under 200 category in the federal guidelines, and we are, I think, one of eight transit jurisdictions that has above average ridership. We actually exceed transit usage for the next higher category, that's the 200,000 to 1 million. And we're very unusual, and we have been fighting, the district, the management, the lobbyists, others have been fighting for extra recognition and extra funding that would help us to meet that demand. We do have unusually high transit usage. It's not where it should be, and you're right, it is a semi-rural county. You will never see, a large use of transit, but it is larger than average. It's better than it could be, and I think we need to capitalize that and try to improve it. I think that cars are definitely necessary for some people, and you will notice that I submitted a letter to the Sentinel advocating the highway widening, a sensible version of it, but in favor of that, because there is a reality we need to get people around, and there are different ways to do that, and cars are, unfortunately or fortunately, whichever position somebody takes, they are part of the landscape.
Unfortunately, I don't understand why cars are so unfortunate. I could understand in a place like Manhattan, right, where you've got it's difficult to park and all that kind of stuff, right, or even San Francisco where it's so densely populated, but cars. For example, to be able to hop into a car and go to Monterey. Now, what is so bad about that? That's a rather significant human accomplishment. What do they want in China? They want cars and they want houses.
Well, you're right.
And this is bad. And this berating of cars, and like I say, a lot of the people that I've met that are bikesters are wealthy, from wealthy backgrounds. They don't have to work. They have no contact to reality. And they're out trumpeting their bicycles, and when they do go to Yosemite, by the way, they'll rent a car.
Oh, you're right. You're
right?
Exactly
so
right.
The level of idiocy, I won't even call it hypocrisy, the level of idiocy, I won't even say it's astounding anymore, because I like this town for a variety of reasons, but some of the idiocy it needs to be addressed. And this berating of the automobile from people that as far as I could figure out, have no connection to the real world other than their check from UC Santa Cruz, they shouldn't be in the driver's seat calling these shots.
Well, are you saying that I'm one of those people? That's all I want to know.
I don't hear that from you directly. I think that certainly bus riding needs its advocates. But I think that what we should be talking about that would be more relevant to the real world would be how to address the issue of intelligent highways and how Santa Cruz can get on this this inevitability early. Why isn't Santa Cruz taking a leadership role in putting itself out for prototyping intelligent highways?
Okay, well, Bob, can we leave it at that and see if we strike some chords in other callers, perhaps?
Why not?
Hey, thank you for calling in.
All right.
All right. Bye. And bikes, a thing of the past, a tool for the rich, an idiotic notion. Give a call if you'd like, although I don't want to spend the rest of the show on this particular topic. 427-3772, but it has been raised. How do bikes fare in terms of transportation here in Santa Cruz as far as, carriers for bikes on buses?
Well, bikes are, I suppose, one of my... I'm all in favor of the use of bikes, and I think they're wonderful for exercise. They're wonderful as a way to get around, but bikes are really one of my pet peeves as a transit advocate, and I'll cite the example of Caltrain, which many of us use when we go to San Francisco, to the Bay Area, to the Peninsula, for shopping, for work opportunities, for medical appointments, whatever. Caltrain faces tremendous pressure from a very active bike lobby, and they have already reserved one level of each of... of one car on each of their trains for bikes. And you do that, and you want more, and you get more and more and more. And so you could fill the whole train with bikes, and the bike activists would still complain. The bikes travel for free, and they occupy space that could be used by paying passengers, and you have, in some cases, or you had until the economic downturn, people standing in the aisles so that there would be space for bikes. So I take a middle of the road position with bikes. I'm glad we carry them, and I'm glad we provide some accommodation, but a transit system cannot just carry bikes. It's got to carry people too, and I don't think bikes are a realistic option, for example, for someone who's going to commute from Bonnie Doon down to Watsonville every day, someone who's making a 20-mile commute, even to get somebody to ride up the hill to UCSC. I walk up the hill, when I go and exercise there or other things like that. I'm a member of the gym there, and so I walk that hill because I find that to be worthwhile exercise, and I have the time to do it, but you never see people bike it. You see them get on the bike shuttle and be driven up the hill, and they ride down at the end of the day. So I don't think bikes are, I don't think bikes are a panacea.
Want to throw in a little more controversy about the Eastern Access Road while you're at it?
Oh, Eastern Access. This is an issue I haven't really said much about. Has lapsed, and it is no longer permissible for the city to provide that road through the Poganip. Environmentally, maybe it's not a good idea either, but it's a project that will not happen now because there's not enough public support, there's not enough money, and that easement has lapsed. There are environmental concerns, etc. We won't see that.
Well, you're listening to Paul Marcel and Sampson on Bathrop's Pier's Broadsides. Normally, civil rights for the poor, but apparently we're moving up the economic ladder here to consider rights for everybody, actually, which is a good idea. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hey, Robert.
Hey, Scott. What's happening?
Oh, not much. Just listening to your show here.
You probably have a few choice words for Paul here.
Well, as far as bicycles go, I think bicycles are a viable solution for many people. I mean, 20 or 30 years ago, the only adults that rode bicycles in most towns were the village idiots. Now, in places like Santa Cruz or Davis or San Francisco, many adults ride bicycles as their sole form of transportation. And, to say that you're putting bicycles on trains or buses is taking away spaces for riders. Well, those bicycles aren't just there by themselves. There's actually a human attached to those bicycles, and they're riding also. As far as the freeway goes, widening the highway, it's not going to do a damn thing. I mean, first of all, widening the freeway is going to be a 5 to 10 year process where it's going to be worse because they're doing the freeway widening. And then there'll be a short-lived relief period when they're done where it'll seem like everything's better. But as L.A., San Francisco, San Jose, all these places have proved over the years, when you widen a freeway, it encourages more people to ride solo. Carpooling goes down and down and down. The more lanes you add, the fewer people that carpool. And so widening the highway here in Santa Cruz ain't going to do a bit of good. If you just widen Highway 1 as they're proposing without changing the fish hooks, that's not going to do any good either. They have to redo the fish hook first or simultaneously in order to make that project even be viable. And as far as operating a train here in Santa Cruz, I think that having a commuter train that would hook up somehow with Caltrain, I mean, they're talking about putting a Caltrain station in Pajaro which would service Monterey and hopefully would service Santa Cruz. And a few years ago at First Night, they had a futuristic commuter train that was from Norway or Sweden or somewhere that was running up and down Chestnut Street, and people could take rides on it. And the thing was quiet. It was a very quiet train. It was all self-contained. It had spots in it for bicycles. And something like that could actually work here in Santa Cruz. Obviously, what's happening with cars, not only here in Santa Cruz, but all over the country, is not working. I mean, this was all a plot by General Motors to rid the country of viable transportation alternatives and make the automobile the number one form of transportation.
Scott, let me get Paul to respond to the three points you've raised about bikes on trains, highway widening, and then this proposed new train. Then you can make a few more points if you want.
Okay.
Okay. First of all, I wanted to say that I agree with almost all of what you have said. And again, with bikes, I'm taking a middle-of-the-road position with bikes on transit.
No, you're not. You're taking a radical anti-bike stance. No, you were anti-bike in what you were saying about the bikes on trains.
Well,
come on,
Scott,
dude. You know, maybe you can't look at it that way, but anybody that's a bicycle advocate would take what you're saying as anti-bike. When you're anti-something, you're not middle of the road.
I didn't say anti. I said that I am glad that we in transit districts carry bikes. I think that there's a limit. That's all that I've said. You know, you can't dedicate, you know, half of the cars on Caltrain to bikes.
They don't. They dedicate half of one car on a string of cars.
Yeah,
bicycles.
It's actually closer to a quarter. I should correct myself there. And what I'm saying is that, you know, having spoken with transit planners at Caltrain, they are going to be running a new service next year called Baby Bullet, an express service. They have a very limited number of cars. The state has just pulled the funding on that project, and we're very lucky to have it. Those trains will be full. There'll be 1 hour express trains between San Jose and San Francisco. The space for bikes is very limited on these newer cars, and the bike activists are already circling in hopes of getting more seats taken out for bikes. And you can't have that on a train that's already full, where you have non-bike riders as well as bike riders. They have to cooperate. There's got to be a limit. That's all I've said. I'm not saying that I'm opposed to it. Some space should be reserved, but you cannot continue adding space when you're not adding space for seated riders as well. That's where you have limits like that. That's where I stand up and say there's a limit. That's all. As far as the highway widening, I would agree with you that if we just go ahead and add a lane to Highway 1, it will be a disaster. What I'm advocating is a high occupancy lane of some sort, either a standard high occupancy lane, or better yet, a high occupancy toll lane, whereby
then you're just providing for rich people that will be subsidized by the poor people.
No, absolutely not.
If it's a toll lane, only rich people will be able to pay for it.
And those rich people will clear space on the other lane that's free.
No, but everybody else will be paying for it. So why would the people that can't afford the toll want to pay for the people
that's
that can't
point.
Afford
the
toll?
The toll would pay the cost of building
the
highway.
No, it won't. It will. It will not.
It will.
It won't even pay for the detection devices.
Have you heard of the Pennsylvania Turnpike? Paid for entirely with tolls. Not a penny of tax revenue.
Every lane is a toll lane, not just the HOV lanes, but every lane is a toll lane.
So the cost was even more.
Well, it's just everybody has to pay. It's not that, you know, I mean, a lot of the roads back east are toll roads.
But in any case, whether we build a high occupancy vehicle lane or a high occupancy toll lane, I want it to be a high occupancy lane. I want it to be for carpoolers, for real express buses. We don't have any real express bus service in this county. We don't have point-to-point express service. Never been seen here. That's what I want to see. That would get people out of their cars.
They have an express bus to Watsonville.
It's not express. It is called express, and it makes about 6 or 7 stops, and it still takes 45 minutes, and it gets backed up in the highway, and it can take an hour. I'm talking about point to point. You get out of Santa Cruz Metro Center, next thing you know, you're in downtown Watsonville.
Well,
end of story.
I mean,
we've never seen that.
Right.
At
one time, Santa Cruz had a great transit system back in the late 70s, and because of mismanagement by the people that ran the thing, federal money got taken away. They had to pay back a bunch of federal money, and we ended up with a crappy transit system here. And the other point I want to make is about this ridership deal that you're touting, that how great the ridership is here in Santa Cruz. Well, one of the reasons that that is because there is no bus system for schools here. So because the school districts do not provide buses, all the school kids have to ride on the city buses.
Well, I'm talking mostly about adult ridership. I mean, I've done detailed analyses of the data. It's mostly adults.
If you were to take away all the school age kids that ride the bus to go back and forth to school, and then if you were to take away the Cabrillo College students that ride the bus and the UC Santa Cruz students that ride the bus, we'd have piss poor ridership in this county.
Are those people not residents of the county, and are they not taking cars off the street by riding the bus? Do we not want their business?
No, all I'm saying is the numbers are skewed. I've heard Les White at numerous occasions tout how great the ridership is here, but the numbers are skewed because of the schools.
Well, it comes from UCSC. It doesn't come from the public schools in Cabrillo.
Yeah, there is no bus. The public schools here in Santa Cruz do not have buses, which they do have in most communities around the country. There are these things called school buses.
Yeah, and
they don't have school buses.
They have
here.
Them in Pajaro Valley. They have them in...
Not anymore, they don't.
They won't after this year, that's true.
But, I mean, the whole thing is that's where the big ridership numbers come from.
Yeah,
and if you were to eliminate those numbers, we wouldn't have much of a ridership.
But there is no harm in providing...
I'm not saying there's a harm in it. I'm just saying that using those numbers without eliminating the school kids, because that's not a realistic thing when you compare it to other communities that have school buses...
Well,
you know, if you were to, like, you know, you're saying the top eight in this size community, well, if you were to, like, check to see if any of those other top eight communities have school buses or don't have school buses, and then subtract our school kids from those numbers, and then compare them to the same communities that do have school buses, we would fall way behind.
Well, many of the eight are also college towns. And from my perspective...
No, I'm talking about... grade school to high school age kids.
But again, that is not a significant category.
Yes, it is.
And I know
it's
that.
It's very significant.
I'd be happy to show you the figures I analyzed.
Thousands upon thousands of riders a day.
Well, let me ask this question. Paul, what percentage of the ridership is school kids?
From memory, I think we sell five. These numbers are from memory. I'll confirm them next time I'm on, or I can follow up off the air. We sell 500 adult monthly passes per month, approximately. We sell 900 senior disabled monthly passes. We sell either 600 or 900 youth passes, and I think it's 600. That would be your school kids category. That's people who are over 5 years old and under 17. So I think we sell 600 of them. In no case is it larger than 900 per month. UCSC, there are 14,000 enrolled students, and we see 5,000 daily UCSC riders. Those may not be the same people every day, because people may have classes Monday, Wednesday, Friday, or Tuesday, Thursday. But on an average weekday, we see 5,000 round trips made on the UCSC services by students. Cabrillo is a smaller number. UCSC represents about 30% of the rides in the system. Cabrillo is 5. I don't have the daily number for you there. But the school kids, the 5 to 17 category with the monthly youth pass, is actually very small, and it doesn't produce a lot of revenue for the district.
What percentage would you say that is?
Let me think. Actually, I can't separate out the percentage as far as percentage of rides, because we only know how many passes we've sold. All the passes are grouped together. So
a lot of the kids don't buy passes. They pay as they go.
You've
got poor kids that are given weekly passes.
We don't have weekly passes at all. Nobody has those in the county. There is no such thing.
They got rid of them?
No, there is not a weekly pass on
there. There used to be weekly passes.
Oh, it's possible, but there is not one now. But what I wanted to say is that from my perspective, again, UCSC is 30% of the rides. It's also 30% of the fares. And the university, every time a student steps on the bus, pays historically 80 cents, whereas we were getting 55 cents on average every time a pass holder of any sort stepped on the bus. So that's money, and that's dense service. That's exactly what you want in a transit district. And it helps provide transit for the rest of the population. you know, basically we are using money from UCSC, leveraging that money to have a larger transit system. I don't think that's bad. I agree with you that a lot of the ridership is from UCSC. It is not from school kids. But I don't see any difficulty in that, and I don't see any difficulty comparing ourselves with other communities, because we do well on that basis.
Okay, well, the other thing is Eastern Access. First of all, the city did not own Pogonep back in the 60s when the university was built. Secondly, there is no place to put a road through there that makes any sense whatsoever. It's too steep. You're talking about building one of the steepest roads in town if you were to put a road anywhere through there. There's no sensible place to put a road through there. Secondly, the money that the city got to buy the Pogonep was park funds. If the city was to allow a road to be built through there, they would have to give back the money that they got to buy the Pogonep in the first place.
Well, no, there's an easement in the purchase agreement that expired last year, I think, that would have allowed a road to be built. I'm not saying I'm in favor of the road.
See, the whole thing is that a couple of years ago, there was a big thing. Well, when the university took over the Holiday Inn, they had a big powwow with Fred Keeley and the city leaders. And one of the things that they did in that powwow was they took Eastern Access off the table for the next 25 years.
Uh-huh.
And so Eastern Access is not going to happen.
Oh, that's what I said.
I know that's what you said, but you were still advocating that it should happen.
Oh, no, I was not advocating it. I was saying it's a project that some people seem to want.
I must be hearing you say different things than what you think you're saying.
Well, it's a project that some people seem to want, and many people in the county don't seem to want. The trolley is a good example also. You've got your folks who live in whose backyards abut against the tracks who don't want it, and then you have others who want it.
Well, the main reason they don't want it is because they got these freight trains going by that shake their houses, and they don't realize that a commuter train probably would not do that.
But they're not talking about building a commuter train. They're talking about building a tourist train.
The only reason they're talking about doing that right now is so they can actually get the state funding that's allocated for this project.
And exactly.
If they drag their feet too long, Arnold's going to take that money away and it won't be available. So, I mean, I think they should get on the stick and get this money and buy the right-of-way before there is no money to buy the right-of-way.
You hit the nail on the head. You're exactly right. That's the problem in Santa Cruz. We dither over these things, and you know, you get very activist groups that don't want it. You get very activist groups that do want it. Everybody talks. Everyone discusses. Nothing happens, and then the money evaporates. That's what we have seen time and time again. I will agree with you on that.
All right. Well, I'm going to get going here.
Hey, thank you, Scott.
Yep, bye.
All righty. And thank you, Paul. And let's give a moment or two in case anybody else wants to chime in before I roll on here. 427-3772 is the number to call. It's Free Radio Santa Cruz at 96.3 FM that you're listening to, or 101.1 FM, or www.freakradio.org on the Internet. So give a call if you're interested, or if you've got questions, or perhaps a few loud, rude comments. Hey, this is the station to make them on. And this is the time to do it while Paul's still in the studio. Otherwise, I'll be left alone, defenseless, having to deal with your comments all by my lonesome. Anyway, I want to thank you, Paul, for being in the studio today. It's a Sunday, so, I mean, it's kind of a frosty one at that. Luckily, I assume you didn't have to sleep out last night.
Yes, luckily, and I'm very thankful for that.
And you, as usual, you have a website. Give me the website again, and tell the folks where to go if they want to get more information, the stats and stuff.
It's www.metroridersunion.org. And if you look, you have to sign up. It's a Yahoo site. We get it for free. It's unfortunate that we have to give them something in return, but we do. So you have to sign up. It's a free registration. And if you do that, you can access a number of fact sheets that analyze some of the facts and figures, the ridership, other things like that. And it's a very good learning experience. When I show those figures to people at the district, the transit district, they're surprised when they see, for example, how important UCSC is or how much UC pays for service. You'll discover a lot of myths will be shattered if you go to that site and read some of the fact sheets that we have there. You can also call me at 831-421-9031 anytime to voice concerns, and I have voicemail there also, so if I'm not in or don't answer, just, you know, feel free to speak your heart out, and I will respond at the next opportunity.
And is there another meeting coming up soon with any issues people should know about of the the infamous Transit District itself?
I'll keep you posted. There are two meetings a month on the second and the fourth Fridays, and the next one will be January 9th. So I'll call in the night before to let people know.
Yeah, we were wondering if they had muzzled you and kind of shipped you off to Dominican or something to shut you down.
Luckily not. It may yet happen. But Robert, if I could, I'd just like to say thank you to you also, a very hearty thanks, because you are one of two media people here who has shown an interest in transit issues and in what we're doing here for the Writers Union in this county. And those two, you're on opposite ends of the spectrum in some ways.
The infamous Heather
you
Berner.
And Heather. Yeah. And I appreciate having this opportunity to chat with you and chat with the public, and especially the call-in format and the discussion and the fact that you allow time and allow dissenting views. I'm really thankful for that.
Well, you know, I really also encourage you and others who want to set up their own show to contact the Free Radio Collective, because we do have time spaces open. You could do a regular show on this issue if you wanted, Paul. And, you know, I'm always happy to have you on here, but you could also have your own specifically, you know, organized show that was on regularly every week. And if some aspect of the community is being ignored, and I'm sure there are many are, that you listeners out there want to talk about, you should get in touch with Free Radio at 427-4523. That's the voicemail for Free Radio, 427-4523. That's not the call-in line, but that's where you would go to make public service announcements, make requests to do shows, give checks, epithets, feedback, whatever you want. 427-4523, because you can go on the air, you know, and this is a valuable and vital resource. We are still under FCC alert and threat of close down, I should say. So you will be one of the many pirates matey if you do join us. But that's really the cost of good citizenship these days, as you probably know if you listen to this station regularly. Paul, thanks for being with us, and feel free to hang in. I'm going to probably do a little take out many of the thousands of phone calls that are flooding in, and then after that we'll go on to something else.
Thank you, and Happy New Year.
Hey, same to you. Well, how about a little music while we ponder this whole situation? Stay with us for a little more of Surreal, and then we're going to probably be listening to the complete, unedited, end-to-end version of the Guns and Butter show that interviews Frank Morales on squatting, which we've heard segments of in the past, but never heard the entire show. So stay with us.
Everywhere you step, it starts to give way. You start to realize it's dreadlock, you're dead when you hit rock bottom. It's such a long way back to the top, rock bottom. You're looking all you could do to make it stop, rock bottom. So far down, you don't dare to look up, rock bottom. In fact, the world's gonna be real tough, rock bottom. Private moment of time, living fast and slow, you're back on the dime. Smart, you're broke, you lost your balance. Blame someone else for your lack of talent. Reach out and grab for everything you pass. No use pile, you're falling too fast. You go tumble down, head run. You know you still haven't seen a word until you hit rock bottom. It's such a long way back to the top, rock bottom. Love to know what you do to make it stop, rock bottom. So far down, you don't dare to look up, rock bottom. Rock bottom. Get back to where it's gonna be a little tough for you from rock bottom.
It's Free Radio Santa Cruz. You're listening to 96.3 FM on the ebbing days of 2003. As promised, coming up shortly is from the Guns and Butter Archive, some programming. Well, Frank Morales, I hope we have the complete show here. I'm going to take a look here and see what we got. Or could it be? Well... Ah, we got the complete the complete show is available. The Squatter Movement, Seizing Housing, with guest Frank Morales, is going to be coming up very shortly. However, before that happens, just a couple of quick notes. First Night is coming, and we're having these end of the year retrospectives, looking back on who did what in the last year. In fact, if you look at today's urinal, I should say Sentinel, the Santa Cruz Sentinel, the daily fish wrap, as we call it, or as I call it, you find a whole series of so-called newsmakers in the news, and that was something I'd kind of hoped to talk about, and I probably will later in the show. They range from Dick Wilson, our city manager for life, who gets his portrait put up there, and along with one page away, Amy Courtney and Cassandra Brown, who successfully challenged the "Don't put your banner on the freeway, but it's okay to put up a flag on one of those overpass policies" by Caltrans. Although I think that was 2 years ago. I think they're a little behind the times. But I guess the final decision came out. And I thought I would actually talk about our own newsmakers. Newsmakers, I feel, don't get any credit, although they get credit on this station and they get credit on my show, but they don't generally get credit in the news media. And of course, I would no doubt rank... a number of HUF members, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom activists, and other activists who do a lot of work, who've actually gone to jail here locally to try to change things, but who don't get any recognition other than in, you know, small circles. And I'm going to encourage people after this next segment to call in and talk about who they feel the real active citizens, the newsmakers who made the news that perhaps
wasn't very widely distributed, or was completely ignored, or was even blacked out, or in the case of Dan White, whited out by the media in the last year. Ranging from people like Tom Noddy, the activist who restored juggling to legality in Santa Cruz. Not that there's makes a hell of a lot of difference, because there aren't too many jugglers. And indeed, I would have preferred things be done differently around that whole issue of street performing and protest that we had an opportunity to do this summer. To activists who fight for basic First Amendment rights on the streets every day, who you may not even know their names. So they're out there because they have to be. They're freezing cold. They're panhandlers, or they're members of religious groups feeding people that are getting hassled but standing up for their rights, or insisting on their right to serve the community, or just simply to be the people that they are. And we'll be talking a bit about that, I think, after this segment. But right now, long delayed, promised for several months, and now finally played. This is November 5th show, Guns and Butter, from the KPFA archives. In case you don't get a chance to hear it today, just go to kpfa.org, www.kpfa.org, and check on the archives recent shows, and you'll get this, and you'll be able to play it for yourself. It's called The Squatter Movement Seizing Housing by Frank Morales, and let's see if we can actually get this thing playing.
With the gun over there.
There was too much democracy. Therefore, that was the reason for this massive protest, the anti-war movement, etc., etc. Their analysis of the 60s had to do all with too much democracy, we have to shrink democracy. So the shrinking of democracy, the analogy is planned shrinkage on the housing front, is to undercut the ability of people to organize if you take out their house.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Frank Morales. Today's show, The Squatter Movement, Seizing Housing. Frank Morales is a writer and researcher whose work has been published in Covert Action Quarterly, Global Outlook, and Midnight Notes. He is the author of Police State America, U.S. Military Civil Disturbance Planning. He has written numerous articles, including Non-Lethal Warfare, Operation Garden Plot, The War at Home, Operations Other Than War, and Military Operations in Urban Terrain. Frank Morales is a New York City Lower East Side activist and squatter. Today we explore his work as a grassroots housing activist and leader of the squatter movement in New York City. According to the October 28, 2003 issue of the San Francisco Bay Guardian, Poverty Amid Plenty, a minimum wage worker would have to work 159 hours a week to afford an average apartment in San Francisco. 25,000 people are on the waiting list for San Francisco public housing. In order to house all of the homeless in San Francisco by the year 2010, the city would need to spend $133 million annually, an amount which represents 0.1% of George Bush's most recent $87 billion request for supplemental funding for the war in Iraq. Frank Morales, welcome.
Hi.
Frank, in addition to being a writer and a researcher, you describe yourself as a New York City Lower East Side squatter. What is a squatter?
Okay, squatter, the way I use the term, is a person or a group of people who, through direct action, secure a place to live. Specifically, on the Lower East Side here and in the Bronx, which is where, you know, I started squatting back in the early 80s, we mean taking abandoned property through seizing that property in the interest of creating housing and doing that collectively and having people who do this collectively organize the resources and the people power to renovate the buildings, to bring them up to code, because a lot of these buildings are trashed in the process of being abandoned. You know, they've either been burnt or whatever, so it requires a lot of work. So basically, by squatting, what we mean is direct action for housing. More sort of philosophically, is that the only way to ensure that people have a human right to a home, and that doesn't remain just an abstract concept, is to seize the housing. That kind of puts flesh on the bones of the whole issue of housing being a human right. It makes it real through the action of squatting. of realizing that right.
When did you start doing this?
I started squatting in 1979 in the South Bronx. The South Bronx is an area where there was quite a lot of displacement and destruction of people's housing. I don't know if people are familiar on the West Coast with some of the imagery of places like the South Bronx, where if you can just envision lot after lot, block after block, just leveled as though a bomb had hit. So there'd be whole neighborhoods. You could stand into four corners in the Bronx and look in four directions and see nothing but, like, level, empty, brick-strewn lots where people once lived. Well, South Bronx went through this whole process of what we referred to and still do as spatial deconcentration, a form of planned shrinkage, so that when we were up there, there were a number of abandoned buildings that were sealed up and ostensibly were owned by the city. And we saw that under Reaganism, there was no way that people were going to be able to get affordable housing other than through direct action, other than through seizing the housing, renovating it, and then defending it collectively. And so that's what we began to do. So I started that in 1979 in the South Bronx. We took over two buildings there with people in the neighborhood and created housing and also utilized the storefronts for people's businesses and drop-in centers and that kind of thing. But the idea is that when people do it, you're immediately put in a situation of illegality, obviously, because under capitalism, you know, you worship private property. So people, you know, they didn't understand, in some cases, what we were trying to do. But we always felt that people had a moral right which surpasses the right to make profit, the right to survive, the right to life. And so that when we took the buildings, we would organize to defend them because we knew that there would be a reaction. And there was. And so that people, one of the main aspects of organizing around squatting then and still now was to organize the ability to defend yourself. So we relied a lot on each other, building networks of people who were both in the squats and in the neighborhoods that would come out and defend people's right to a home like that. So I started doing squatting up in the South Bronx at that point and moved down to the Lower East Side in 1985 because I grew up in this neighborhood. So, you know, I came back here for that.
Were you an organized group that did this when you started doing it in 1979?
No, we were neighborhood people who just saw that the buildings were sitting there and that it was clear that more and more people were being displaced. If you lived in the Bronx or in poor communities throughout the country and you could see that people were being pushed out, neighborhoods were burning down, banks were disinvesting from neighborhoods. It was a synergy of effects that was unleashed against these communities. From my perspective, a conscious strategy to depopulate the urban centers of people following the late 60s. They were seen as the terrain of insurrection, and therefore the strategies that were enacted to, you know, the phrase being spatially deconcentrate these communities. We recognized that the only way we were going to survive the effort to displace us from these communities, these are poor, working-class poor people, you know, and artists and so forth and so on, was to seize the buildings directly, manage them ourselves. And we've proven that people can do this, you know. People tend to be able to cooperate if given an opportunity to work collectively together. In fact, that's one of the predominant features of being human, and that if you allow for that, then it's amazing what people can do. So that people manage these buildings, and that's how the thing got going. In the Bronx, in the early stages, there was a lot of community support, which was important to sustain them, local benefits in the neighborhood to raise money. I mean, don't forget, in 79 and 80, hip-hop was just really getting going up in this neighborhood. And you know, we had a lot of connections with people in that area who would do, you know, a lot of stuff with us, and we'd raise money, and people who knew other people who needed housing were able to move in to the houses and so forth. So, you know, I've always advocated that people who are having difficulty affording where they're living, yeah, there's approaches that deal with rent strikes and seizing the occupied and vacant apartments and other kinds of strategies. But in terms of the abandonment situation, in areas where there is abandonment and so forth, public entities, housing entities that have taken this property over and so on, they should take these properties and organize to defend them and renovate them and create housing for people, not as a way only to meet the short-term goal of creating housing for themselves and those that they're working with, but also to put political pressure on the system which is set up right now to do nothing in terms of creating any kind of affordable housing for poor people. There isn't a penny of federal money that is going towards creating housing for the poor in this country. So the only way that people are going to get the kind of housing that they need, rather than prisons and shelters, which is another kind of housing that the state is supplying, they're going to have to take it through direct action. So that's what we started doing in the Bronx, and then later on down here on the Lower East Side.
How would you do this? You would find an abandoned, boarded-up building, and what? Just open it up and move in?
Yeah, the way that we would do it is that, I've given you kind of a summary. We have a kind of an ABCs of this. You know, we wrote up a lot of this stuff over the years and publish and give it out to people, because there is a bit of a science to it without sounding overly highfalutin. But we would take buildings that looked to be in decent shape and do a kind of reconnaissance, you know, have people go in and check them out, make sure that the buildings were structurally good. And we'd have friends who were architects and others who, you know, would help us do that. So that would be in the early stages. And here in New York, we were always telling people that what we were not about was creating some kind of public spectacle that would be symbolic squatting or something to create a protest and to try to create a media event around making a demand of the city to provide housing, et cetera, et cetera. We were not about making demands. We were about basically working clandestinely to take the housing. Some of us have no confidence in the goodwill of the state to provide housing, and so see the demands as really kind of useless. And it's that using a clandestine approach, we would work in a building for 1, 2, or 3 months before we effectively put on the front door, so to speak. So we'd spend some time analyzing the situation in terms of ownership of the building and get that background information, organize groups of people who were compatible and, you know, who wanted to do this together. In the early stages here in New York, we'd collect mail, have people send mail to themselves or have others send mail at their address and meet the mailman on a street corner or something like this and begin to create a legal case for residency in the building. Because as people began to move in and actually live there, the powers that be might be interested in pushing them out, and by creating a residency status as opposed to a trespass status. Basically, we took approaches that would ensure the most likely possibility of success. We were about creating housing. We weren't about creating kind of political statement or symbolic this or symbolic that. We took a kind of a paced approach to securing buildings for the long term. So after 2-3 months of clandestine kind of work within the building, both in terms of its immediate renovation, there's immediate needs for electric and water, et cetera, et cetera, we would then go public, so to speak, and have the front door put on and kind of smoke out whatever opposition was going to be smoked out. And at that point, we'd be prepared to defend ourselves through having created some residency status there, having networked with people in the community to defend the building through public demonstrations and other kinds of approaches. And, you know, all in all, to give it our best shot for maintaining, holding the buildings. And we were successful both in the South Bronx in terms of the movement up there with people on the move and some of the groups that were working up there on it down here. Now, in terms of some of the politics of this thing, we always felt that, and to this day believe that the buildings should and are, in fact, autonomous, that we never had any central organizing umbrella or something like this. Each of the buildings was autonomous. The people that worked there and lived there ran it. There was no outside authority to tell them what to do, who to bring in or who to evict or how much money they should put into renovating the building, so that we always maintained a strict autonomy among the various buildings and so on. But what was a centralizing element for us was the collective defense, so that what was referred to as our eviction watch network, which was a phone tree among other things, it was a defense mechanism apparatus, if you will, of the squatter scene down here that essentially constituted our organization. And that was it. It was not that we had any kind of centralized organization. We would have, obviously, a lot of sharing that happened between the buildings, and people would share tools and so forth. And at our peak, we were working in about 22 buildings here on the Lower East Side. We've lost a number through arson. We lost some buildings through Giuliani and some of the other mayors. They brought tanks and helicopters and SWAT teams and various approaches. And we, you know, we would mount campaigns to try to push that back. The long and short of it is 11 buildings have survived the onslaught of both yuppiedom and police state attack here in the Lower East Side. And now, to bring you totally up to date on this, is that these 11 buildings have received some kind of normalization from the city, wherein the ownership of these buildings that we're in, which we always felt was illegitimate anyway in terms of the city owning this or the city owning that, but from their point of view, title to our buildings has been transferred to this not-for-profit agency, which ostensibly will manage our sort of finishing renovations in some of the buildings to bring us up to code, and at which point the buildings will be transferred to us legally.
Well, it sounds like it's been very successful. I'm speaking with writer, researcher, and urban squatter Frank Morales. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Frank, when you talk about collectively defending the buildings, what you mean then is if the police showed up and wanted to evict you, that calls would go out and a large group of people would assemble, and yeah. What? Would that sort of intimidate the police?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's not about violence. You know, we don't possess the kind of artillery that the SWAT team has. You know, in taking these buildings, we're not unconscious about what our status is in terms of the legal structure in this country. So we need to devise ways that we can defend ourselves. So we, you know, utilize different methods. And one of the things that we did early on was to create an eviction watch list, which was a phone tree that connected all the people in the buildings. And as I said, at one point we had 20 plus buildings. And this is roughly, what, 30, 40 people, I guess, per building. So it's like that kind of network. And also people in the neighborhood who we'd have a table on the corner of Tompkins Square Park on a Saturday afternoon and ask people who wanted to sign the eviction watch list so that if in the event that we were being pushed out, they would come to defend us. So they would sign up. People would sign up, and if they couldn't come, then they would be put on a separate list that from work they could call the city authorities who were evicting us. So in other words, everybody who wanted to help out could help out depending on where they were and what they could do and so forth. It was a question of organizing for defense. Once people understood, you know, what you were doing, they supported it. Obviously, the people in the buildings early on understood that, hey, if I don't support you and your squad, then you're not going to support me and mine. So it's very basic there. So a bunch of people would come out. We would expect all the squatters to come out to support each other. I mean, that was the vibe among people. It's like, you know, that was what, and that's what happened. That's why we were able to bring people out. So if there were two or three cops and some city officials in front of a building standing there with a pad in their hand saying, according to our records, this building belongs to, you know, so-and-so. And we'd say, well, we have mail, we reside here, we've been fixing this building up, and we're not leaving, period. And further than that, we're not letting you in if you don't have a warrant with somebody's name on it.